And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, March the 27th, 2018, 14 minutes past the hour. Scott Spears along with you for the ride today. Do want to remind you, quick housekeeping note here, coming up next hour, as many of you know, you can't miss the promos anywhere, Roseanne, the legendary television series, will return to the airwaves tonight after a 21-year absence on the ABC television network at 8 p.m. And next hour, live on this program, we will have Estelle Parsons, who portrayed Roseanne's mother, Bev Harris, for the entire run of the original series, and is back for the reboot, which will kick off tonight. So we will talk with Estelle Parsons next hour. By the way, she was one of the original Today Show girls on the Today Show when it started with Dave Garraway way back in the 1950s. So, Estelle Parsons next hour. Now, this hour is going to be very interesting because there is a book out now that is fascinating. Living in a Mindful Universe, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Heart of Consciousness. The author of this book is author of the New York Times number one bestseller, Proof of Heaven, Dr. Eben Alexander. And we're also joined by co-author of this new book, Karen Newell. Dr. Alexander, Karen, how are you?
We're doing great, Scott. Thanks so much for having us on.
Yes, hello.
Good to speak with you. I want to start, Dr. Alexander, how did you come to write this book? What was the reason for this?
Well, I think it's important to point out that when I went through the events back in 2008, severe gram-negative bacterial meningitis and a weakened coma with basically a conscious experience that is completely inexplicable by our conventional neuroscience, that book, Proof of Heaven, was really more of a question mark than anything else. It simply affirmed that these experiences happen to people, but then making sense of them and trying to interpret it and understand what it means is a whole new challenge. And of course, I had the experience, and just like millions of others, came back to this world wondering how to make sense of it. And it's been 9 years since that coma, and I have learned a lot, and I've found that, in fact, my journey of discovery very much parallels the modern scientific assessment of the mind-brain connection. And where that's going is very counter to what our conventional science would try and preach. And I think that this kind of message and awakening and my journey as well as that of many scientists investigating these phenomena is an extraordinary body of research that this world needs to know about. And that's why Living in a Mindful Universe, to me, was kind of an imperative book of trying to get this knowledge out to the world.
Karen, how did you become involved with this?
Well, I had, when Eben and I first met, he asked me, or I asked him about what he learned on his near-death experience, and of course all of that is written about in the book Proof of Heaven. But when I asked him about that, I was expecting that he might learn a very important spiritual lesson, and what he told me was the brain doesn't create consciousness. He was very much a scientist. And my answer to that was, why would anyone think that it does? That the brain creates consciousness, because I had always understood that primarily we are made of soul or spirit. And so when we first started to get to know each other, we realized we were at kind of totally different ends of the spectrum, at least before his coma. And I was able to help him really get to know more about the spiritual side of his experience, especially the concept of love and connection and oneness that we all share. And so I got involved with writing this book because we were really trying to bring science and spirituality together in ways that many would say is impossible. But in fact, science can support the reality of the spiritual realms. Our conventional materialist science mainstream has not really accepted all of this, and so our book is an effort to bring all of that together.
Dr. Alexander, my first memory, which I assume is my consciousness, is 3 years old. I remember my third birthday. That's my first conscious memory of life. Now, I did not have any, I don't recall anything before that. I don't recall anything during the birth process. So why would my consciousness go on after I die? Was it there before I was born?
I would say that the modern scientific study of consciousness, mind, brain, and human experience would say absolutely that your conscious awareness was there before you were born. In fact, from my journey that is described in Proof of Heaven, it was very clear to me that reincarnation made a lot more sense than one incarnation than of, you know, nothingness or heaven or hell or what have you. And so eternity of consciousness is really a fundamental part of this. Now, I had grown up in a Methodist church in North Carolina, so of course my religious beliefs before my coma did not include reincarnation, but I've come to realize both from my journey and from extensive study of the scientific literature since my coma that reincarnation is something there's so much evidence for it of one would have to be quite willfully ignorant to deny its reality. Now, the scientific study of it, from my point of view, is very strongly supported by the work of Ian Stevenson, who is the head of psychiatry at the University of Virginia from the 1960s onward for several decades. And he really started that work, and of course it started when he was approached by parents who said that their children remembered past lives. And he went at it, as any psychiatrist and modern thinker of the 60s would have, to disprove those accounts. But much to his surprise, what he found is that often the very best explanation was actually of reincarnation. And now, followed up not only with the work of Ian Stevenson, but by Jim Tucker, who's now the head of Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia, they've actually now accumulated more than 2,700 cases of past life memories in children where the most ready explanation, and this is with careful attention to deflecting any fraud or any kind of misleading data, but in the intense scientific study of these cases, 2,700 cases where the majority of them are best explained as cases of reincarnation. Now, what they point out, though, is if you want to harvest any memories from a past life, you're better off doing it between ages 2 and 6, because older than age 6, those memories start to be covered over by natural processes. So one should go after these memories at that early age to try and recover them in pristine fashion. Now, I will also point out, though, that over the last 3 decades or so, especially with the work of people like Stanislav Grof and also of Brian Weiss and of Michael Newton and others, we've come to realize that transpersonal psychology, that is, the psychology of human beings that acknowledges that we are more than just an incarnation in one lifetime, but that in many ways you can often explain the hardships and difficulties we face in this life and their resolution through acknowledging that we had previous lives that kind of set up the stage for us to have the various challenges and issues in our lives of this incarnation. And by taking that much bigger view, as transpersonal psychologists have done in more than 100,000 patients, you start to realize that it can make a lot more sense when we acknowledge past lives, which usually are not of famous people, just because, as you'd expect, statistically, most of us are not famous people, and so our past lives were not of famous people. And at any rate, the point is that we can often make much more sense of these lives by acknowledging the much broader tapestry of involvement of our souls having lived previous lives as part of that ascendance towards oneness with the divine that cannot be accomplished in one lifetime.
Dr. Alexander, I think one thing we all wonder, most of us have seen somebody die or we know somebody who has died, and when they're dying, whether it's by pain or through medication, when that moment happens, they are unconscious. Now, people are usually working on them or just letting them go. Does that person know that's happening?
I would say that person really at that point has one foot in both worlds. And so they know clearly that they are moving into a very different territory. The shock to those who believe in the conventional scientific materialist model is that they expect that as you die, as your physical brain dwindles down, that your awareness goes down to nothingness or blackness. And of course, the big surprise is that's not what happens. For example, witness the final words of Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple Computer, in that beautiful New York Times op-ed piece written by his sister, Mona Simpson, who was there when he passed over. And his last words were, "Wow, oh wow, oh wow," and that's because of what he was witnessing. Those who work in hospice, nurses who care with patients who are transitioning from the physical body, many of them have stories of similar to show to them, whether it's seeing a wisp of smoke or spirit coming out of the patient as they leave their physical body once and for all, or episodes of terminal lucidity where someone who, for example, has a worsening dementia and may not have uttered a meaningful phrase for weeks or even months, right as they approach death, they seem to come back to life. They awaken. They gain tremendous reflective abilities, cognitive abilities, memory of life, reflection, and conversation with those at the bedside, family members, and what have you. And often at a time when they see the souls of departing loved ones coming there to escort them over. Now, these are not some new age made-up fables. These are very common in the hospice and in the nursing world. In fact, we met a hospice nurse in England a few months ago who told us that she sees some evidence of some form of lucidity, terminal lucidity as it's phrased, in up to 98% of her patients. The generally accepted numbers in the, for example, the Alzheimer's research community is that something around 5 to 10% of Alzheimer's patients demonstrate this form of terminal lucidity, of coming back to this world in a way that completely defines our simplistic and false conventional scientific notion of brain creates consciousness and the material world is all that exists. So I think that the big reality, especially for those who are exposed to this on a daily basis, like hospice workers, is that they see plenty of evidence that death of the physical body is not end of the soul, and that there's much more that goes on in continuing our relationship with loved ones and others in our soul groups beyond the death of the physical body and brain.
Karen, once that happens, when I flatline out and I am no longer there, where do I go? What's going on? Do I know who I am?
Well, you know, it's hard to answer that question absolutely, but we know from many reports of near-death experiencers, those who get close to death, whose body has died, their awareness seems to continue. Now, many people stay kind of attached to this world. They see the doctors working on them. They try to communicate with their loved ones any important messages. And, of course, the loved ones usually don't hear or know that they're departed loved one is trying this, but many who are open to that actually communicate with them. Some have even seen or witnessed somehow their loved one going on to actually die and have a life review. A life review is something that most of us can expect, and this is where you might review every situation in your life, every significant situation, but not from your point of view. Very interestingly, in a life review, you actually experience those events from the point of view of the other person you're interacting with. So our relationships are actually very critical things that happen on a daily basis here on Earth. And so what you do is you experience how that person reacted to, say, something you said or a way that you behaved. So these can be very good things if you were a very loving person in your life, you'll experience what it felt like to receive that love. Many people, though, are not so loving, and many of us, you know, do things without really thinking, and those also will be reviewed in those life reviews. So any kind of pain and suffering you may have inadvertently or consciously doled out to others, you will experience from that other person's point of view. Now, then what might happen is you would then decide, oh my gosh, you actually judge yourself. Did I behave in the proper fashion? Did I behave in a way, you know, that golden rule really comes in handy here. Did I behave in a way that I would have liked to have been treated? And then we make decisions then on how we might formulate, as Eben was saying, this idea of reincarnation is actually very much in our hands. We might formulate how we might choose to interact with people in our next lifetime and what situations we might want to set up in order to learn very important lessons that we decide we want to learn in that moment. Now, there's many people who, you know, believe in this concept of we go to heaven or hell, and that a god might, a separate entity might do that judging. And from all of the research and knowings that we've come across, that is not the case. There is, you know, potentially a form of hell if you happen to dole out a lot of pain and suffering when you're experiencing what that might have felt like from the other point of view. But it's really a matter of personal choice and judgment in that moment. And we can expect that to happen, but I wouldn't get too worried about it right now in terms of, oh my gosh, what have I done in my life to get, you know, punishment for. But what we really want people to focus on is how can we serve as conduits of that love that exists on the other side. We will encounter it when we die. We will feel that force. And the more of us who can bring that into our daily lives now, the better off we'll be when that life review comes around.
Now, none of us knows anybody who has died and stayed dead. How do we know this life review happens?
Well, I think it's such a common feature of near-death experiences going back thousands of years. I mean, literally, you can go back to the writings of Plato, 2400 B.C., where he talks about the Armenian soldier Ur, who was killed in battle and lay dead on the battlefield for several days before he was finally put up on a funeral pyre. And then he came back to life right before they lit it up, and boy, did he have a story to tell, because fundamentally what he realized and reported to his fellow soldiers is that when you die, your life flashes before your eyes, you go through a review of all the critical lessons still to be learned, and what you find is the most important thing about your life is how much love you have managed to share with others. This came from a soldier killed in battle 2,400 years ago to his fellow soldiers after being dead for several days. I think that's the important thing to remember is when you review near-death experiences, you're not just talking about cases of cardiac arrest with 5 to 10 minutes of downtime in their consciousness. I mean, some of the most extraordinary near-death experiences involve people who were dead for several days, like George Rodinea is one of the most well-known ones. So this is not just some little whimsical New Age thinking, and it also is something that goes far beyond your belief system. In other words, people from all continents, atheists, people from all religious backgrounds have come to have life reviews and realize, oh my God, there's more to this. Now, a very important point is that there are also something called shared death experiences. They are phenomenally identical to near-death experiences, except they happen in people who are totally healthy at the bedside of the dying loved one, or you might be 3,000 miles away. It doesn't matter. The loved one can still come through and take your soul on this journey. But what the shared death experience is someone, for example, at the bedside will notice that the walls and ceiling and floor disappear, and then they see energy beings or light beings coming into the presence of the departing soul. They see that soul rise up out of the body of the patient, and in a shared death experience, the soul of the bystander goes along with the soul of the departing loved one, even to the point of witnessing a full-blown life review of that departing soul, and then the soul of the bystander comes back to this world. Now, when I first started giving talks about my experience in Proof of Heaven, and I started the talks 2 years before the book came out, I would often have people come up to me after a talk and say, I never told anybody this before, but. And then they would share with me some story, usually around the death of a loved one and kind of witnessing the events that happened that showed them it was not the end of their connection. But about one case in 20, I would hear one of these shared death stories, and they absolutely grab your attention because these are not people who have oxygen deprivation or other things going on in their brain. They're perfectly healthy and normal. And for them to go through the same experience as a near-death experiencer and even to supporting that life review is really extraordinary. Now, I would say that shared death experiences were first officially defined by Raymond Moody in his beautiful 2011 book, Glimpses of Eternity, that he wrote with Paul Perry. But Karen and I get to hear shared death experiences all the time. And I would steer those who are interested to look at the research of William Peters. He lives in Santa Barbara, California. He's a hospice worker who had his own NDE, and what he started is what's called the Shared Crossing Initiative, which trains hospice and healthcare workers and interested family members in trying to nurture and establish an environment where they might experience a shared death experience and may actually go along on the pathway as their loved one is departing this physical plane. The shared crosser might participate in that crossing, even to the point of a full-blown life review. So these are something that can actually be cultivated in those coming back to this world.
Every religion and every section of every religion has a bit of non-belief or a group of non-believers, I guess is what I should say. Some called atheists, some called agnostics. And one of the reasons I think this exists is because nobody can definitively say what happens. Now, they can tell you they know they're going to go be in heaven. I don't know anybody who thinks they're going to hell, but people believe that it exists. How do... When I die, if I drop dead right now in this chair, am I going to see people and be with them who have went before me? Am I going to go through this life review? Is there any way to know definitively?
Yes. In fact, the Tibetans, for thousands of years, have used dream work to help prepare people for that transition. They came to realize that if you can, in some fashion, take control of your dreams, like in lucid dreaming, that opened the door to being able to better handle kind of your free will and determination of what your soul did when liberated from the body at the time of physical death. Now, what Karen and I talk about in Living in a Mindful Universe is a very modern form of the same thing, that people can learn through a regular practice of meditation, of going within. They can come to examine this broader connection with that universal mind that we talk about, the higher soul that overlaps with that God force, that God consciousness that we can all come to know as sentient beings. So you don't have to wait to be smote down by bacterial meningitis or be struck by a truck or something to have an NDE. We can learn it through going within, through meditation, and that's where Karen's work with Sacred Acoustics is so important.
Well, I just wanted to add, too, you know, you were asking how are we going to run into people that we know, and yes, you're right, in religious beliefs, it's a matter of faith, but there is actually work done, especially by Michael Newton. There's a book called Journey of Souls, and he actually, using a specialized form of hypnosis, he was able to regress people back to the moment of death in their previous lifetime. And so you kind of have to buy into the reincarnation system. But what he would do is get people to go back to their previous life to this one, lead them up to the point of death, and then in that hypnotic, altered state of awareness, they would recall exactly what happened. And yes, it involved reconnecting with people that they loved here on Earth. It involved going through that life review and making plans, as we stated. And yes, Eben brings up a good point. We can do this ourselves by getting into expanded states of awareness and being open to all of these ideas. Many of us are, I would say, very resistant to thinking of new ways of looking at the world. Many of us who are very ingrained in either scientific concepts or religious concepts of actually knowing what's going to happen when we die, and many scientists will tell you nothing happens very confidently, and many religious people will tell you, well, no, of course, I'm going to reunite with God. And so somewhere in the middle, there's an answer. And I think it comes from people like Michael Newton and from people who personally explore these realms to find out answers for themselves. And it really behooves us to pay attention to how can we continue our awareness. That Tibetan dream work is very useful because many people are afraid to die. And if we know something is going to happen, we may not know exactly what that is. But being prepared for that can be very useful.
I think one of the problems is with reincarnation. Now, if somebody dies and they come back and they are put in a hypnotic state and recall how they died and things of that nature, if somebody in my family, a loved one, died 50 years before I die, and they were reincarnated. Now, I wouldn't know that, but when I die, how are they going to be there if they've been reincarnated?
Well, one important thing to stress, as I discussed briefly in Proof of Heaven, but often cover in my talk, is that there's a very different form of time flow, what I call deep time, that has everything to do with the actual ordering of events and learning and progression of conscious awareness, you know, in that bigger sense. So I would say that Earth time, how we experience it here, is never going to limit the more important features, say the presence of a departed loved one appearing to us when necessary at the time when we leave the physical plane. It that is given that our relationships and all of that soul growth that accompanies those kind of relationships and lessons of the soul school are the absolute reason all of this exists. Just know that there's no way that the universe would make the mistake of having a soul be unavailable to another soul at the time when they're most important, say at that transition. So it's very crucial to understand that Earth time and our appearance of kind of time and space and the four-dimensional reality that we experience here in this world in these incarnations is a projection from this side of the veil. That is, it is not fundamentally built into the underlying fabric of reality. And this is it's a complex set of topics, but it's something that we address in Living in a Mindful Universe to try and explain how all of that works.
Anybody who has died in my lifetime, where are they now?
Well, I would say that they are in that spiritual realm that is actually outside of Earth time. So in other words, for example, there's a after-death communication or a deathbed vision that I present in Proof of Heaven that occurred to a very good friend of mine who just so happened to be the chairman of a neurosurgical training program and one of the top neuroscientists on Earth. But it converted him spiritually very strongly because what he witnessed in his own father was extraordinary. But I will point out that the vision that he witnessed was of his father coming in contact with his own mother, who had passed over 65 years earlier. That would be the grandmother of my friend. And my point is, she didn't sit there for 65 years watching the clock waiting for him to pass over. Because in essence, in that deep time, in the kind of time flow and causality of that spiritual realm, all of those kind of events are really happening at the same time. So that there is no need for any kind of waiting out the clock, because the Earth time clock is one that's very much part of the fiction on this side of the veil. So your loved ones are absolutely in that loving and beautiful realm, But, of course, they are also there to welcome you when you pass over, go through your life review, where you get to feel either pain or suffering or love that you've shared with others, and you feel it firsthand in that life review, and then go through what residual lessons are to be learned in the presence of your soul group, and then all plan that next incarnation. That is what is going on there.
Karen, what do you... That place, what is that place like? Is it, I know who they are, I see them, is it a spirit, what is it?
Well, most people will say that, including mediums are people who actually are professionally, you know, kind of credited with being able to do this on a regular basis, and mediumship can actually be proven scientifically. Wimbridge Institute has certified a number of mediums who's found with through very strenuous kind of research situations, they're able to be accurate in about 76% of the time, which is really remarkable. But many reports that come back say that we can actually see our loved ones in the most prime they were in their life. So usually that's around age 20 or 30. When we reconnect with our spiritual friends and loved ones, they look like they did at the prime of their life. Another thing that you can expect is that many people say is that that reality seems more real than this one. This one is actually foggy and murky by comparison, and everything is more hyper-real over there. Now, many people will say also that loved ones don't show up in actual bodies, but they show up as more energetic, more, say, balls of light, but we have no risk of not recognizing our loved ones because we feel their presence. Everyone knows what it feels like to be with your loved one, and it's different from one person to the next. So what it feels like to be with your dear grandfather may be completely different to what it feels like to be with, say, a sibling or a parent. And so we recognize each other based on sort of an energetic signature. It is similar to what it is like here, I believe, just so that we can be familiar with what we're used to seeing. But beyond that, I believe everything is very spiritual and flowing and loving and available.
For people, if there is no hell, and that's not the idea, people who commit suicide, are they there?
Yes, people who commit suicide are absolutely there. In fact, in our book, we talk about my own stepfather who took his own life by actually swallowing a pill of Xanax that was given to him for anti-anxiety. And he committed suicide, and it was very sad for me, for my mother, for my family, and I had read a lot of different things that some of those mediums and other people say happen to someone when they commit suicide, and it wasn't very comforting. And so I set upon a task to really find out for myself, is he okay? Is he still there? And I asked some of my friends who knew how to connect with the souls of departed loved ones, and they were able to connect with him, and they told me he was okay. Now, this is, you know, fine and good. You hear this, but you still wonder for yourself. And eventually, about a year after he died, I had a rather amazing dream where he did come to me, and it wasn't like a regular dream. This was a very different kind of dream than what I was used to having. It was very vivid. I felt energetic vibrations that weren't present in normal types of dreams. And many people actually connect with the souls of loved ones who have died. And so it was very heartening to me in my dream when he came to me having committed suicide that, yes, he was still there. He was present. He gave me information that I ended up validating with my mother that I could not have known and that he could not have known. We write about this in the book. It's a little bit of a story, but the bottom line is he is there. He is well. He is happy. He is healed. He has learned what he needed to learn. What drove him to commit suicide, he now realizes, was not really, his action of committing suicide was not really the best way of handling that, but he is okay, and he probably at one point will reincarnate and readdress those issues in a future lifetime.
The people who are fearful of death, it's the number two fear in the United States behind public speaking. When the moment happens, does that fear just go away?
Absolutely, because you realize that you're far more than the physical body. I think it's a gigantic shock to those who believe the modern conventional materialist scientific view to realize that, in fact, we are conscious in spite of our brain. And once you get the brain out of the way, your consciousness is far greater. And this is something that has a lot to do with the modern scientific evolution of understanding about the relationship between brain and mind, and viewing the brain more as a reducing valve or filter that allows primordial consciousness in this very limited trickle of an apparent here now and a false sense of self. The life review very importantly shows that sense of self is only there to support the drama of this soul school for us to learn and teach each other. But the life review, where you experience any pain or suffering or love or comfort that you may have handed out to others as part of your residual lessons, it obviates the need for any eternal hell. Because someone who's been busy handing out pain and suffering to others and leading a very greedy and selfish life will have a very unpleasant life review. And that is all just to nudge us more towards the primary kind of compass that should be guiding our lives and our choices and decisions in this life, and that is to show unconditional love, compassion, mercy, acceptance, and forgiveness to all fellow beings. That's really the lesson that humanity has been charged with over the last 5,000 years or so. And I would say that this awakening that we report coming to humanity and living in a mindful universe is all about that final kind of phase of our destiny of finally living the golden rule, treating others as we would like to be treated. And it's really because we're all sharing that one mind. To hurt another is to hurt myself. And so the deepest lessons of near-death experiences and of all this awakening that we see coming to the spiritual aspects of humanity, as we report in Living in Mindful Universe, is really all about that lesson, that golden rule, and it's based really in the neuroscience of consciousness and philosophy of mind all around the phenomena of consciousness that is coming to this world and disproving the simplistic and false notions of materialist science that the brain creates consciousness and therefore when you die, your conscious awareness comes to naught. The exact opposite is what happens. And this is all based in a modern interpretation of the measurement paradox in quantum physics and in the deepest studies of human experience, scientifically assessing the reality of things like reincarnation and of deathbed visions and of the primacy of consciousness in the universe, which is really the scientific truth that is coming to the fore.
When it comes to disease, life expectancy, Alzheimer's, dementia, if it's not God and Jesus and the Bible, is it just the luck of the draw? Is there any purpose for any of this?
There's plenty of purpose to all of it. As I realized after my coma journey, as described in Proof of Heaven, I came to see that the hardships and difficulties in life, the challenges, and certainly as a physician I would include in that injuries and illness, that in many ways they are the gifts, they are the engine that drive our growth. It's in facing such hardships and difficulties that we are able to recover the love of the universe for us and share that love and connection with others. It's by taking this much broader view that acknowledges that each and every one of us is much more than just a physical body in this one little birth-to-death incarnation, but that we have multiple lives in this soul school effort of learning and teaching and growing towards oneness with the divine that cannot possibly happen in just one lifetime. But I came to realize that those hardships and difficulties are something that, in essence, our higher soul and soul group help to plan in making this incarnation come to fruition. And it's really how we deal with those things. And that's why it's so important to acknowledge that the deepest lessons of this awakening coming to humanity and that we discuss in Living in a Mindful Universe and first covered in Proof of Heaven is that how we live these lives in this material world is the most important. This is why the universe exists. is for us to fully manifest the free will of our higher soul in ways that reflect that love, compassion, kindness, acceptance, and mercy for all fellow beings in making the choices of how we live these lives.
Karen, when we die, we're reunited with the people who are already there. There is no clock. It's a different clock. Then we wait for reincarnation and part again?
Well, that's one of the theories, but a lot more goes on when you're over in those other spiritual realms. According to some of the research that we've come across, people report continuing particular jobs and particular interests. They still communicate with and pay attention to what's going on with their loved ones here on Earth. It's very interesting because, you know, Evan brought up a story of an after-death communication. There's another one in our book, Living in a Mindful Universe, where a woman is driving along the road, and her father, who had died sometime before that, suddenly came to her and gave her a warning that a car was going to lose its tire and you know, run her off the road. And so she immediately heeded that voice and pulled over. So what that tells us is that our loved ones are still paying attention. They're still involved in our lives. So grandparents who maybe, you know, didn't see the birth of their grandchildren are still here, and many children will report actually communicating with dead relatives, and their parents are rather amazed when they show them a picture and say, oh yes, that's grandma. And so they remain active in our lives. That there's some evidence that our personalities still continue, that we continue with interests here on Earth to explore them on the other side. But it's most important to realize that what we're really trying to teach people is that the spiritual world is real, and it's not just available to us when we die. It's actually available to us here and now, and not just the idea that we can connect with our departed loved ones and figure out what we do when we die, but how do we access that pure source of information that is there at the core of all of it, that loving creator that Eben speaks of? We can connect with here and now, and it's about realizing that our internal world is much more important than we've been led to believe. Materialism is all about the external world, things, objects, you know, and what we're trying to focus people on is our internal world, and that is our personal experience of consciousness, and that is the piece of it that continues when we die. Our material world is completely left behind, and it's our awareness that continues. So the more we can develop a relationship with that awareness here, the more we can access creative inspiration, the more we can access maybe the reasons we came here in the first place, all kinds of things that we can find out to affect our lives on Earth. It's what survives when we die. So the more we become aware of that internal presence, the less fearfulness we'll have when our physical body actually leaves us.
If I want to reach somebody who's gone, if I want to figure out what the purpose of my life is, how do I do it?
Well, one of the methods that we teach very actively is using these sacred acoustics audio tracks to actually help reduce that mind chatter, to reduce that awareness of the physical world, to make us more aware of that energetic part of ourselves. And when we do that, we can use our active intention, making free will choices. So if we want to connect with someone who has died, our advice there is to imagine that you're already with that person. What does it feel like to be with that person? And then in combination with listening to these different types of sound that we create, we actually are able to get our thinking mind out of the way and actually make that connection. It can also happen in a dream. It's not necessary to use the sound. You can simply, before you go to bed at night, imagine being with that person and do that night after night after night, and eventually an amazing dream should pop up. And finding your purpose is done in a similar fashion. The more you can align with that energetic part of yourself, whether it's through a form of centering prayer or meditation or using these different sound technologies, you're able to align with more of who you are, and your purpose really just happens automatically. Many people get caught up in, what is my purpose? Why are we here? And we want to know what job should I have or what act should I take. And more often, it's just a way of being. Our purpose is to be who we truly are, and that is unique from one person to the next. And each of us is a critical part of that whole. We're all connected. We are all meant to be here to be reflecting a different part of that one mind. And if we can come more in touch with that internal essence, that will lead us to knowing what our purpose truly is.
With about 3 minutes left here, we talked about suicide earlier on, and that's a big thing right now. If there is no consequence for it, and somebody is highly depressed, that's scary, because if you are reunited with these people regardless, isn't there a fear that people might go and do that?
Well, I think the important thing to point out here is suicide and homicide are absolutely never the correct answer. The only exception to that, I would say, is a physician is in someone who has a terminal disease, who is in terrible suffering, pain, and discomfort, and it cannot be alleviated through any medical means. And if there's no hope for recovery, I think in that circumstance, one can have a justifiable situation for suicide. One thing I would point out is we often present with Raymond Moody, who wrote the book Life After Life in 1975, that really started this whole near-death experience movement. And we love Raymond. He's just a wonderful soul. And one thing that he points out about suicide is one of the very few kind of absolutes in his research over the last five decades, is that if someone attempts suicide and has any of the elements of a near-death experience, like the life review or witnessing the infinitely loving force at the core, that God force of pure unconditional love, and come back to this world, they never attempt suicide again. The important thing that they see there is they witness the tremendous love that the world and the Creator had for them that they somehow missed out on, and that's why they ended up making a decision to commit suicide. So when they witness that love that the universe and that others have for them that was unrecognized and helped them to go down a pathway of suicide, they realize that was not the correct answer. So as far as the soul journey goes, suicide is never correct, and it's a tremendous kind of challenge for the life review of the entire soul group. But just as we often experience in the life review an incredible love that the universe and others have that we might not have recognized, it serves a tremendous purpose in avoiding suicide to realize that that love is always there and that we can find it by going within.
I want to mention this really quickly before we go to the last question. The book is Living in a Mindful Universe, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Heart of Consciousness. Eben Alexander, MD, Proof of Heaven author, is the author with Karen Newell. Ever since the book about the boy who went to heaven, the knock on books like these have been, it makes money, these books aren't free, we all want the answer, the Bible's the number one selling book in America, nothing is free, and we can't disprove it no matter what we do. For people who say that, what do you say to those people?
Well, I mean, for one thing, I take that as an entree to say, well, some of it is free, and that's why we have a free 33-day email course at ebenalexander.com to help share this message. We feel no soul left behind. I think it's important to point out these experiences are very common. This is not just about the occasional book that is written. It's about the tens of millions of Americans who have had these experiences and are looking for answers. And so we really have to admit, and this is why the scientific study is so important, is this really... this understanding of the larger nature of who we are is of crucial importance to all of humanity now. We have followed way too much the kind of false sense of separation coming out of materialist science as opposed to the deep sense of oneness that comes out of quantum physics and the deeper understanding of the nature of consciousness. And this is not just kind of an idle question of what happens when you die, but it's a far more important question of what is the nature of human spirit? Where did we come from? Where are we now? And where are we headed? And the conventional view that I worshipped before my coma of materialist science is false. It's absolutely false. And the scientific study of consciousness is what takes us to this next higher level. But I would say it's absolutely crucial that we realize how important this awakening is for humanity, because in fact the status quo and that false sense of separation that comes out of the materialist scientific model is killing us. You know, there's a rising depression, and there's a rising suicide risk, and there's a rising opioid crisis in this country. A lot of things are going the wrong direction. And I would say that much of that is due to the spiritual vacuum by falsely leading us to believe that it's a material world and that the only thing that matters is accumulation of material wealth, and failing to acknowledge that the most important thing in this universe are the relationships we share with our fellow beings and the lessons we're here to learn and teach. And that is where I would say this is not just an accidental kind of idle curiosity and chaos of information, but a very ordered instruction from the universe to get on the right pathway and get out of that crazy cul-de-sac of scientific materialism. And the divorce of human spirit from science and technology is what led to all the wars and violence and conflict in the 20th and early 21st century. We need to move beyond all of that insanity and madness. And that is what this awakening is all about and why it is so important.
Dr. Evan Alexander and Karen Newell, Living in a Mindful Universe, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Heart of Consciousness. Thank you both for being on the show today. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks so much for having us. Great to be here.
Yes, thank you, Scott.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
At the 2016 Republican National Convention in